time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
When too much networking would be barely enough.
Rooters, witches, firewall,
a podcast on the data networking industry. Rooting, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Whatever it is, we'll talk about it. Be ready. Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and various ideas and then get together to discuss them. Get comfortable while we get around the card table and gasbag about networking stuff. Our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do the business. So, without further ado, let's introduce the people on the show today. First of all, I'd like to welcome Ethan Banks. Ethan, how you been?
Hey, good. I had Friday off and enjoyed some time off with the family and feeling really good today. It's a beautiful day here in New Hampshire.
And welcome back. It's good to see you. And also, another one of our steady regulars is Dan Hughes. Dan, what's happening with you this week?
Well, I finished my vacation time. I am just getting ready to start a new job on Monday and digging up the garden. That's pretty much it. I haven't turned on a computer in 2 weeks. This is the first time to get this this going now. I turned on a computer.
And you didn't get twitchy anywhere? Like, you know.
Not quite.
No, I think no,
as long as I
have
my little browsing and my Twitter, I was okay.
Okay.
I think Dan just said the iPad is not really a computer. That's what I heard.
Well, he's damn right, too. I liked your Twitter this week where you said, what should I be wearing for my first day at work? And I think Ethan made the suggestion that you shouldn't wear your shirt that says, do I look like a people person?
I'm thinking he should wear that. That's how you get to know people and just let people know where you stand.
That's how you get started.
Like
All right, and this week I'm very pleased to present that another host for the week, Jeremy Philibin. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm good. Fresh off a week at Cisco Live in Las Vegas and now back to rainy Orlando, Florida.
Orlando. I have no idea where that is. Somewhere in America.
It's south.
Jeremy Philibin, you may know him for his blog at www.jeremyphilibin.com. You can find him on Twitter at jphiliben. That's F-I-L-L-I-B-E-N or something like that. I'm sure he's got it written on his blog. And he's also a CCIE and a CCDE, one of the few around. And he's pretty well known for that as well. And I'm also pleased to present this week one of a very well-known person in the blogosphere, Brandon Carroll. How have you been, Brandon?
Great. I've been good. I've been out at Cisco Live. I just got back. I'm actually packing up my house, moving from actual rainy Seattle down to Southern California. So it's been a hectic week, but it's been pretty good.
Hey, welcome back. And of course, you can find Brandon Carroll at Twitter at Brandon Carroll. That's BrandonCarroll. Can we have people with a few less characters in this Twitter thing? And on his blog at www.globalconfig.net. And of course, Brandon is also a trainer for AsCulta.com and also a CCIE. Strangely, a security CCIE, at which time I also owe an apology to Dan Hughes for saying that he was a security CCIE for the last 2.5 months, but it's his fault for not pointing it out.
I kept meaning to correct you on it.
It's his fault for not pointing it out sooner. I'm not taking responsibility.
Well, Greg, you're just so intimidating. That's the problem. You just scare us all so very much.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't dare tell you that you're wrong.
Well, one day we'll all actually get
it's
together.
It's that Crocodile Dundee thing.
One day we'll all get together and you'll realize I'm just a middle-aged, fat, balding white guy. And there you go. We should kick off the discussion around the card table and see what we've got. But the first topic that we've put together this week has been many, many reports of people getting very long lead times on all products from 2900s, 3700s, 3500s, right the way up to Nexus 7000s. And the two most painful points are delays on the 6500 and the 7000, the Nexus 7000. I personally am facing a 90 to 120-day lead time on Nexus 7000 deliveries, and it's starting to get very, very painful. It's causing me a lot of stress. So, Ethan, I know you've had something about this. You're experiencing the same thing from your Cisco reps?
First part of the year, it was the exact same thing on the Nexus. It was roughly a 60 to 90 day at that point, and I think it ended up being about 90 before product was delivered. And then on 2900s I have right now, they just told me, July sometime, we hope. So I've got just 2911 routers, the most common router you could possibly imagine from the new G2 line, and yet long lead times.
Jeremy, have you experiencing anything? I know you've done some. You've got a big network that you do some stuff with.
Yeah. We've purchased Nexus in the past. Lead time last year wasn't that bad. What's somewhat interesting is I did have a meeting at Cisco Live where John Chambers more or less conceded that long lead times was an issue that they've been having. They're down to two products that they really have an issue with, and you just named them both, the Nexus 7000 and the Catalyst 6000, 6500 series. So there were some stories about why. The main one that I recall was that something was single sourced, and there were issues with the single source. So they've gotten away from that. But yeah, it's definitely an issue in the industry.
The thing with the single source excuse, I mean, they were using this excuse 6 months ago, and look, it's all very well, and you know they made a mistake and so on. But 6 months later to still be having these kind of problems for a company of their scale, I just don't see it as acceptable. To still be rolling out the same old excuse after this time. And it isn't just the two products as well. I've been having problems getting hold of ASAs, sort of 5-6 week lead times. Not quite the crazy lengths you were talking about there, but still, you know, very, very slow, unavailable through distribution. The ISR G2 routers, as Ethan mentioned there as well. I don't see how they can have had their best quarter ever last quarter when they can't actually ship products. It just amazes me.
Jeremy, did John suggest that things were going to get better, you know, or what did he really say?
Yeah, I mean, he did suggest that. One point he made is that going into the economic downturn, you know, their intention was not to scale back manufacturing so much that they couldn't ramp back up. But I wonder if that's basically what happened. You know, it's pretty common for a large manufacturer to decide to slow down building inventory when they don't really see a huge demand going out.
I'm wondering if there's a different message they're sending internally. I had a meeting with one of my Cisco reps this week to review a wireless project that I've got in the pipeline. And when I was complaining a little bit about the lead times for some product, he suggested, yes, well, you know, we don't know that it's really going to get better. And our philosophy with our customers has been, you know, buy early and, you know, buy often kind of thing. It's like, okay, I don't know that I can really work that out with my budget. You know, a lot of times you can't predict so far ahead of time what it is that you're going to need. So that, I don't know that that's I got the impression from what he was saying that it doesn't sound like internally to Cisco they think it's going to get much better. So this is it's a concern.
Yep. The other strange thing with it is that why we then sort of stick with Cisco, and it's one I did myself recently. I had a particular project where I needed some equipment to be in on, you know, by a certain time. And Cisco were talking crazy, crazy lead times. Yeah, it was going to overrun by 2 months, 3 months, this kind of stuff. And Juniper were knocking on the door at the same time saying, guys, I can have you these switches on Monday. You know, how many do you want? We have buckloads of them. And, you know, we didn't do anything about it. We stuck with Cisco. I know there are situations where, you know, in a sort of larger environment where maybe you're committed into a certain technology. I mean, again, if you're doing a big Nexus deployment, you can't really chop and change. But I wonder how much business is being lost that way. Are people actually changing, or are they just sticking with it and saying, okay, we'll wait the 2 months?
I think Cisco's burning up their capital. So you have a relationship with your customer and you have a certain amount of goodwill and it's established, and the longer these sorts of problems go on. I mean, to me, I'm coming to the end of my tether. I've got product supply problems. I'm getting feature delays. So Cisco comes forward and tells you about a feature, like, for example, overlay transport virtualization was originally promised 6 months ago and then it was shifted back, and it's only just shipping now in the first versions. It was originally, you know, sort of indicated that it would be GD by the end of this year. Now, that's just one feature. We've consistently had timelines for ASA features, Cisco Security Manager features, CS Mars is now dead. I'm starting to question whether the Cisco business is as vital. Like, Cisco has been a really sound company to do business with. They've always had product. They've always been in control of their product lines. They've delivered on what they've committed. And just in the last 2 years, since Uncle John's gone off and started buying flip digital cameras and building Linksys routers and, you know, all this other stuff, it's like he's not focusing on his core business. And the question is that a decision? Are we getting close to that point where customers start to turn away and look to other places? And I'm just not sure about that yet.
It's hard for me to sit here and I don't know. It's so comfortable to have that Cisco branded box come in the door. You know what's in that box. You know when you rack it, what's going to happen when you boot it up.
You know what the support's going to be like.
Figure it.
You know that
maintenance, find people who can drive it.
You don't have to go down to purchasing and have an argument about getting a second supplier and letting a tender. You don't have to go and negotiate a second round of maintenance contracts. You don't have to change your change control system. So you just end up stuck with the same old problems that you've got today. It is hard to make a change.
You know, at the same time, certain things like switches, I mean, at the end of the day, a switch is a switch, pretty much. They all do 802.1Q. You can do LACP with most of them, and there's some kind of a backplane in them that's blocking or non-blocking, and you make your plans around that, and they've got some amount of port density, and they all kind of do the same thing. Does it really have to say Cisco on the front to work? And the answer is, of course not. But we've talked about this on the show before. What's that last thing that's going to push us over the edge and say, all right, we're buying something else this time?
And is it the fact that they won't sell you one?
Okay, well, on that point, I mean, have a look this week. I mean, that makes a great segue into the next topic, which is that Sun Oracle's this week's released a 72-port 10-gigabit Ethernet switch. Now, this is a 1RU switch. It's meant to be top of rack. But my goodness sakes, it's got 72 ports of 10-gigabit Ethernet, which is full non-blocking bandwidth, with 72 10-gigabit Ethernet ports or future upgradable via interface line cards to 16 40-gigabit Ethernet ports. Now, it also has Ethernet Layer 2 and Layer 3 support, so it does some sort of IP routing. Now, this is obviously not a core switch for your network in the sense that it's a 1RU. I'm not sure what the power supply units and so forth like. But 72 ports of 10 gigabit Ethernet in a non-blocking backplane for a single, you know, rackable type form factor. Other companies can make what Cisco's got. Now, if Cisco can't get it together, maybe we should be looking at this. I mean, I think this switch is a very exciting thing and we should be looking at it. Has anybody else had a look at that?
I was just double checking you because I couldn't believe they got 72 ports in 1RU, but they do. How are they doing the heat management on that thing? These 10 gig blades seem to throw an awful lot of heat. Boy, that's
I mean, the thing about it is, that, you know, with 72 by 10 gigabit Ethernet ports, that's the maximum density. That's way beyond the maximum density of a 6500 and is approaching a quarter of the density of a Nexus 7000 with 10 gigabits. And 16 40-gig Ethernet ports is very close to half the 40-gig capacity of a Nexus 7000. I'm doing some very rough calculations off the back of my head here. So if this can be done in 1RU by somebody who's not a recognized switching vendor, why is Cisco not giving us that? That's my question.
Yeah, but does it do FCOE?
Well, do you care? I mean...
No, I don't.
I know you're fishing there. Yeah, well, yeah, look. You know, the answer
Greg, you and I share a passion to see Fiber Channel just disappear from the world at some point.
I just don't understand Fiber Channel. I don't understand the answer. And this is the sort of switch that will take it away. The answer, you know, if you can buy a low-cost 10-gigabit multi-high density, this is a storage. This is a director-class storage switch here.
Exactly. My view, exactly. You know, we can get IP to ramp up to Fiber Channel standards, then let's just let Fiber Channel go.
Well, I have seen, I mean, not, I don't want to get onto a Fiber Channel rant, but iSCSI and NFS works very fine for storage traffic under certain conditions, and this type of switch is exactly ideal for most medium-sized data centers. I mean, a 72-port 10-gigabit Ethernet switch non-blocking is the same as a director-class Fiber Channel switch.
Oh, I was going to say, that's going to be your positioning if you bring this in, show this to your Cisco SE or your Cisco sales rep is, you know, it doesn't do all the features that we do. You know, it doesn't run these routing protocols. It doesn't run, you know, these Fiber Channel features. But
and I'm going through the specs, Jeremy, and you're exactly right, because this is a very basic switch. I mean, it does all the basic stuff you need, but nothing too fancy. It does .1Q, it does LACP, it's got all three flavors of spanning tree, and IGMP snooping, routing, it just does static routing, RIP, and OSPF V2, and that's it. This thing doesn't do much else.
It's meant to terminate servers. So the idea is that you'd go and buy a bunch of Sun, you know, the old Sun systems, and you need to collapse them together. And Oracle wants to own everything, right? They don't want to see their servers be sullied by somebody else's switches. So this is their switch they're going to promote so they can provide you a guaranteed end-to-end service. But this is a very fine unit. I mean, 72 ports of 10 gigabit Ethernet in a 1RU probably sucks a fair amount of juice, but I tell you, it's going to use a lot less than the room heater that the Nexus 7000 is.
Is this their own silicon, or is this something that they really just kind of rebranded?
No, it's their own. Sun had their own network silicon coming for quite some time, but they never quite managed to get it out. Looks like Larry Ellison's managed to push it out the door to see what happens. Speaking about data center Ethernet, this week Cisco announced its Fabric Path strategy. Fabric Path is the name for the Trill standard that Cisco's put together. So effectively the data center bridging. Let me read you some gum from the thing. Fabric Path is a set of capabilities within the NXOS software that combines the plug-and-play simplicity of Ethernet with the reliability and scalability of Layer 3 routing. Why did they bother to write that? What's that all about? Using Fabric Path, you can build highly scalable Layer 2 multipath networks without spanning tree. Duh, that's what data center bridging is all about. Anyway, the story is that basically Trill, which is the transparent redundant interconnection of lots of links, which is the IETF standard to replace spanning tree. So in the past, the IEEE standard 802.1D and RST 802.1W have all been standards that we've used for spanning tree, and we've all basically given up on spanning tree. So Radia Perlman, who wrote the spanning tree standard way back when, has gone over to the IETF and developed the Trill standard, which has been ratified, or is very close to, sorry, the final standard in Trill got submitted this week, so it's on its way for ballot soon. Now, Cisco went out and has said, of course, that they'll be supporting Trill, and in the fine tradition of calling a spade, they called it Fabric Path. Is Cisco marketing a genius or what? Why not just call it Trill or Trill Plus? Am I the only one who's going to get on his moral high horse about this, or is it everybody got the same thing? Jeremy?
Well, it is silly for the engineers, but anyway, I'm not Jeremy. But no. I just wanted to make a real simple point, which is they're playing on this term of fabric where they've been, with the Nexus boxes, they've been making such a big deal about having a unified fabric in your data center and so on. And I think they're just playing off of that terminology, trying to keep that fabric idea in people's minds.
Well, of course they are. I mean, you can almost see the marketing sitting around with their braces and their ties wrapped around the tops of their heads saying, you know, hey, we've got a data center switching fabric and we've got our backplane fabrics and our, you know, blah, 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 our fabric path. This makes perfect sense. Absolutely linear. Except for the poor engineer on the ground who's actually got to translate from fabric path into Trill. Why not call a spade and get on with it?
Well, this will prevent you from buying that Sun switch, right? It won't support fabric path or something like that.
Oh, harsh.
But the interesting part of that announcement to me was that it's not going to work on your native Nexus 7000. You've got to upgrade Supervisor, I believe, or it's a different line card. I forget which. But,
different line card. There's two line cards in a Nexus 7000. There's an M series and an F series. And the F series is the ones that support Fabric Path, and the M series is the ones that support Layer 3 routing. So you actually have Ethernet comes up and pops into your F series, and then goes up to your M series to be routed, and then goes back down onto F series. Woohoo!
Ew.
Yeah. It's and the F series currently supports 3210 gigabits on a single module. And there's an M1 and an M2 module, and then there's an F1 and an F2 module coming in the future, which each one has different capabilities or features of some.
So this is still an oversubscribed card, isn't it? Yeah,
yes.
It sure is.
And will also require the fabric in the back of the Nexus. You know, if you're going to have higher densities of gigabit, 10 gig Ethernet, you're going to need new silicon fabric in the back.
Yeah. They really missed the mark with this in some ways. I still can't believe they shipped that chassis after all this waiting, and it's still a still an oversubscribed setup with the first generation cards. But well, we're still buying them. We're not getting them, but we're buying them.
If you're lucky, you might get one that's sort of gone far enough that it's actually become stable and usable and got a sensible bit of hardware in it. If you wait long enough, which you might have to.
All right.
I suppose the other interesting point on it is they've gone very early with this naming of a standard. So it's kind of like, are they trying to take out Trill by making the named version or the branded version of it, if you like, first, and probably doing a lot of marketing around that so that people are going, Trill? What's Trill? I don't know anything about Trill. But you know, they'll be familiar with the Cisco branded version. And
well, it's even more confusing because Fabric Path will contain a number of enhancements to Trill, or so-called enhancements, that will be Cisco proprietary. So to ensure that you don't buy anybody else's equipment and only buy Cisco, they're going to come out with their own version of it. So in a very real sense, if you would think of Fabric Path as being a proprietary implementation of Trill, you'd be mostly correct, is my current understanding of how it's going forward.
Hey, Brandon, in a from a training perspective, since that's the area of the world that you come from, are you guys getting a lot of demand for either the next training on the Nexus project products, or some of the newer stuff like Trill coming down the line? People asking about it?
Yeah, you know, we are, but the problem is just getting equipment for a lab. We get requests for it, but I think so far, Advanced Services is probably the only people that are doing any training for it. Just because for a training company to feasibly put together the material and a lab exercise, it's, you know, hardware for a lab, it's just it doesn't make sense. So we hear a lot of requests about it. Some of our data center courses are really popular. DCNI is one of them. But aside from that, no, I actually don't hear much about Trill at all.
It's still very early. Very, very early. It's not even ratified by the IETF. And the IEEE still hasn't finished its part around the DCB standards.
There's definitely no shipping code that supports it yet, so.
Right.
No. I just think it's ridiculous that Cisco Marketing can't call it what it is. Just whatever it is. So I guess the other big news for this week has been that Cisco Live has been running down in Las Vegas. Of course, we had Uncle John giving us his usual keynote, which this year everybody got very excited about. But I think we'll probably leave the keynote to later on in the discussion. But Brandon, you were there this week. Have you got any particular takeaways from Cisco Live that you thought were exciting?
You know what? I think the whole thing for me is just great to be at. I don't necessarily know about the online version of it, but actually being there in person, for me, it's more about meeting the people that I'm communicating with on Twitter and whatnot through the blog. It's more of actually meeting them face to face and building the relationships there. The world of solutions is always what it is. It's all the vendor booths, all the swag. You know, you go around and I mean, how many koozies do I need to hold my beer, or how many blinky pins for my badge do I really need? But the keynotes are always good. And from a trainer's perspective, it's really tough for me to sit through some of the sessions. But you know, that's just me. I know for a lot of people, it's worth going for the training. But I mean, I think there's a lot more to it than just that.
What about you, Jeremy? You were there this week as well.
Yeah, I'm an infrequent trainer. I do a little bit of training here and there, but I'll agree. Some of the sessions are significantly better than others. So let's put it that way. But that's understandable. Cisco's probably got, 200 different speakers there? You know, their best speakers are used up, and they have other speakers as well. I enjoyed the event. This is my fourth year in a row, which long ago, that makes me a net vet in Cisco Live Speak. Long ago, I thought that was just for companies
that means you got to have the one-on-one session with Uncle John. Hold hands and dance or something?
There were no dancing, fortunately. I didn't drink that much. But there were probably 50 to 75 CCIEs in that room, and you know, they escort John Chambers in for a good hour and a half of Q&A, and no topic off limits. I thought it was really good. One thing that became blatantly clear is if you spend an hour with John Chambers, you're going to like the guy no matter what. He's just one of those likable people.
Well, did he come across as transparent? Or did he come across as like he was working off of note cards, giving very specific answers like a politician might?
No. I'll throw one thing out there in specific that I thought was really interesting. Somebody asked about the relationship with Cisco and HP and Cisco and some of the other server vendors. And John Chambers came right out and said HP is a competitor. And I think he said that before, but it's quite an impact when he's standing there, you know, right in front of you saying it. But then he went on to say that the other server vendors could go either way. You know, that they're not necessarily a competitor. They're not necessarily an ally. It's more or less up to them, he said. Which I thought was very interesting. We're not going to be seeing Nexus Blades in an HPC class enclosure anytime soon. But I don't know that we'll see them in the Dell either. I think they're already available for IBM. But
I think IBM's going to stay partnered with Cisco. I think IBM's all about professional services, and they sell hardware because that's part of their marketing strategy. But it's not what they really want to do. So What John's hoping for there is that IBM will stay partnered with Cisco.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear from what he said that he wants to be a partner of IBM, but it depends on what path IBM wants to take, I suppose.
Well, he doesn't want to see the numbers impacted, because HP's turning away from Cisco will drop 10% off Cisco's revenue this year, especially as they ramp up their networking thing. So that's going to be a big challenge for Cisco to overcome. And if you look at, his share, The Uncle John magic is all based around the fact that his numbers go up every year. He delivers more profit and more growth every year than any other company. And if HP leaving is a serious whack, but, if IBM turns around and goes in, the Uncle John mystique's going to be lost. He's going to be looking a bit like he's in trouble. And that half of the thing about...
It all speaks to why they keep expanding into these markets that the network engineers like us don't really want them to go into. But to keep that revenue stream up, to keep growing sales numbers and profit, they got to get into these other markets, which is why I think they're doing it. Did John Chambers say anything about some of these other markets and the fact that some of us don't really care for it because all of a sudden we can't seem to get routers shipped?
Not specifically. It was brought up at least once that, let's not forget the core competencies. But I think he addressed that in the keynote as well, that he can't let go of the core competencies, the routing and the switching. Brandon, is that right? Did you sit through the keynote?
Yeah, he did mention that. But, again, it really does look like they've kind of gotten away from that. At least to a degree. I think it was last year that he said that every single market they get into, they want to be number one in. And if they can't be number one in it, then I think we tend to see them just drop out of it and kind of give it up. But, how can you be number one in every single one of these areas you're getting into and then still maintain the core? So, I don't know.
I spent time working for General Electric a few years back, and they have the same philosophy. If you're not number one or not number two with a vision to get to number one, then there's no real sense in being in that market. You could probably see that with a couple, security products that Cisco's let go of recently. Yeah. They'll be back to the table with a new version, I'm sure, or a new new solution. We'll put it in their speak.
Yep.
What about the sessions themselves? Is it all pretty much the same as years gone by? So one of the things that I found heading back to Cisco Live year on year is that the sessions get fairly repetitive. Although, let me put a disclaimer in there and say that the networkers I've been to in Australia and in Europe are much smaller events, and so there's not as much choice as there is in Las Vegas. So maybe I'm a bit got a different viewpoint. But do you find going back every year it's the same old sessions?
No, Brandon, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that to a degree, there are the sessions that are always going to be the same, the repeat speakers, the ones that you want to you want to go because, you know, it's the CCIE, Tectorials, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think what I noticed is where the marketing dollars go, you tend to get more sessions. So, you know, data center seemed to be that was Cisco Live. Cisco Live to me seemed like it was all about the data center this year. And so I think you got a lot more sessions where they focused on that. They were trying to beef up their presence with that. So I don't think it's too repetitive. I mean, with this 200 speakers and different classifications, security and voice and service provider and certifications, you can pretty much pick and choose. I don't think they're
The last conference I was at, I loved listening to the voice people whining about the fact that there wasn't as many sessions as there was in previous years. Because voice is kind of over. You know, like the whole unified comms thing is just, right, we're finished with that now. That's a stable, mature market. We won't, you know, all the marketing resort. Because a lot of these people who do the speaking are actually funded out of Cisco's marketing budgets, not out of their engineering budgets. And so the marketing budgets are getting larger for the DCB as they try and establish themselves in that market. And then unified comms, which is now stable, all those engineers are being transferred into other areas of the business. So there isn't engineers available to write those presentations, and there's not engineers available who can, you know, whose budgets are going to pay to fly them there and to, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's part of it as well. Sorry, that was just – I just love listening to voice people whine.
Yeah.
I'm glad that market's mature. That was not I'm not a voice guy. I don't care for it. Just let it be an application on my network. I don't really want to know how it works.
It's not magic. It's not rocket science. It's just
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Last year I did presented a 2-hour session, and this year was kind of hoping to get a 2-hour session as well, because they're, you know, it's easy to keep people engaged for 2 hours, but you can tell on the certification side they're cutting back. And so I got a call from the program manager for certifications, and he said, I don't have any more 2-hour sessions, but can you do a 4-hour? And so Now that was brutal. Looking back, I'm thinking next year, if I can't get a 2-hour session, then it might be worth just paying myself to go.
That's a bit harsh. So they give you a free ticket if you do the prezo, do they?
Yeah, well, I mean, you had to pay your travel and hotel and all that, but they give you a conference pass.
Did he give you a specific topic he needed you to cover for 4 hours, or were you supposed to fill time?
Well, it's kind of like they put out an open call and say, hey, what do you want to present on this year? And then you just, you submit basically a proposal that says, I'll present on this, I'll do it for 2 hours, these are the topics I'll cover, and then if they like it, they come back and go, okay, you're on. So...
I never knew that. You learn something new every day.
Yep.
I know that as a blogger and a tweeter, I know that Cisco Live doesn't cater much for us, because when I went to Barcelona, we were basically frozen out of all of the internal stuff. So we were not welcome in any of the press lounges or any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I guess Cisco's not really serious about social networking, but that's a different sort of a thing. I find that hard to believe. Any other areas about Cisco Live that were exciting?
Within that NetVet conversation, a couple of things came up that I thought were interesting. Hopefully, this one goes away. there was a pretty pointed question, and I thought a good question about, CCIEs versus CCDEs and how the programs are being built. They said, there's a couple dozen CCDEs in the world, and now Cisco's given them a career path to the architect. There's 20,000 plus CCIEs in the world, and there's no career path. So why did you build a career path for a few dozen people without building, a master engineer career path for CCIEs? Which on the surface sounded pretty interesting, but John Chambers turned it around and said, well, how many of the CCIEs in the room would like a career path to go up to another level? And it was 50-50 at best of people that wanted you to wanted them to leave things alone or wanted them to build a master engineer certification. How do you guys feel about that?
It's sort of hard to imagine what would be, if you consider the depth of material that they cover within the CCIE program, if you want to be have more knowledge, have more engineering capability, you do another track. That's how I look at it. So you've got the CCIE routing and switching, which would be most of us, and then you've got a much smaller group that's done also security or service provider, some other track. And then the very rare people that do three, four, I guess there's a very few people that have gone all the way up and done all the tracks. And that's, I don't know if that's a, that that's a career path necessarily, but that's how I would think of it. If I want to get into it deeper and more, then I'm going to go after another track. I have children, so I'm not going to do that since they still shudder when I mention a test or a CCI or anything like that. Daddy, you're not going to do another test, are you? And they get all worried. No, no, kids, I'm not. Not right now. Daddy promises.
I think people might misunderstand what the CCDE is all about. My view is that the CCDE is for the resellers. So remember, Cisco's customers is not you and I. Cisco's customers is the resellers. Cisco makes products that end users buy, but they sell them to resellers who sell them to customers. And you've got this triangle of, it's like a love triangle, which always ends up badly. And I think the day will be coming when resellers will have to get out of the way and Cisco will have to take their business direct. But CCDE is a reseller certification, and the intention is that the resellers will be able to bring in a design expert for the very largest accounts, and they will be able to supply people that, you know, the Chase Manhattan banks and the, you know, the very largest firms can say, if I go to a reseller, they can bring in somebody who can guarantee me that they have the technical knowledge on how to do this design. And that's what the DE was built for. It wasn't built to give you a career path, and it wasn't built to, you know, validate your, you know, ability to memorize stuff and to work stuff out. It was built so that resellers can have a better presentation to the customers so that Cisco can sell more stuff.
I think that's fair. You know, at this point, they haven't made CCD any kind of partner requirement. It doesn't have any particular value in the partner world beyond its, say, expert level certification value. But it's probably a matter of time, you know, when they fill out the ranks to, you know, hundreds or I would think a few hundred people, they can start to squeeze that into the partner system and either give an additional discount or more likely just make it a requirement for the largest partners, you know, gold or maybe make something above gold.
And make that, a platinum reseller who's got specialist, somebody who's...
Yeah, but I think so.
Yeah, remember, the DE is in the path to the architect now, right? So, which to me just seems like a good old boy club when you see who's getting it. So,
well, it always is. Those certifications always are when they start. They have to start somewhere. It's like the first CCIE was appointed by his peers, by peer acclaim. How do you, you can't have a test if the test doesn't exist. And so someone's got to write it. And how do you do that without a bunch of people getting around working out? Nortel has had the same thing, or did have the same thing. They had the Nortel Network Architect, an NNA, or some weirdy, weirdy term. And it was all very similar to what Cisco's done. In fact, the Cisco CCA was almost a carbon copy of what Nortel did 10 years ago.
The three-com wizard, if anybody remembers that one.
Yeah. Okay, a little anecdote. When I actually started off on CCIE, I didn't want to work with Cisco because I didn't much like them. And I wanted to go and do three-com and be a three wizard. But as it turned out, someone else was already had been tapped for that particular position, and I was forced to go and do the Cisco ones. But it's worked out pretty well, I must say.
Yeah, you won that one somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have been installing 3Com Super Colliders. That would have been great.
I could have been installing Tipping Point IDSs by now or rebadged Extreme Switches. What? No 3Com? No 3Com. And now I'd be working for Hewlett-Packard. So that'll all be entertaining. I am hoping to get some HP people to come on the show in the next few months and tell us about their products. And so that'll be entertaining at that particular point in time. The other big event, of course, which happened at Networkers during the keynote was that Uncle John announced the Cisco Seus, is that how it's said, tablet. And the Cisco Seus is effectively a 7-inch tablet computer running Android, same as everybody else's tablets which are coming out, except everybody seems to have gone gaga over the fact that Cisco wrapped some plastic around a standard hardware reference model with some software, and goodness me, they're going to write an application for it with a bunch of developers out of India that looks like a telephone and might even run video conferencing. Colour me excited. I am so thrilled, I am vibrating in my seat. Guys, you at the keynote, tell me what you think. I mean, is it really that interesting, or is it just another bloody telephone?
Oh.
Well, if if you were at the keynote, I don't know, Brandon, I was impressed. It was about a 30-second, almost like an action film, I think, where they unveiled this thing, and I was ready to buy one. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Add it to the collection of toys, right?
Yeah, but is it, so my point is it serious? I've seen these toys before. You know, when IP telephones, there was an IP telephone from Cisco 5 years ago, which had a video conferencing unit built in. How's that going?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we aren't using it. You know.
They can't. We were talking earlier in the show about lack of focus on Cisco's part, and this just plays right into that for me. I read a number of different brief articles on people who covered the press, you know, release of this product and announcement of the product and so on. I think one person put it real well when they said, I don't know that Cisco's going to be able to sell these because where they're trying to notch it in is between, for business customers, somewhere in between their Lenovo laptops and their BlackBerries. Right. And I would be in exactly that boat. I've got a Lenovo laptop and a BlackBerry that I that covers me. The BlackBerry, when I'm abroad, keeps me in touch with email and voice. And the Lenovo does when I need to do real work or on a plane or something like that. I don't know where I'd use a CS, what I'd use it for. And I read some of the, you know, you're supposed to be able to dock it and pick it up and go to a meeting and do this and do that. And it's just a toy. It's a gimmicky thing, and people are going to buy them and say, oh, this is fun. And then in 2 weeks, I don't think it's charged, or I don't, you know, what, oh, I scratched it, or I dropped it, or, you know, the quality of my voice call sucked. I don't really want to use this thing anymore. It's going to be a burden on the IT people to support the thing, and then it's just going to get forgotten about, and that'll be it. It'll be just another chapter of in the book of dead end products Cisco's introduced.
Maybe it seems like if they're sort of going down this mobile, enabling video to the mobile device, integrating it into your sort of enterprise voice architecture or video conferencing architecture, why not just write an app? You know, I mean, the thing's running Android, so why not write an app that's going to sit into the Android App Store, and everyone who goes and buys their Android tablet from whoever they buy it from, or buy an iPad or an iPhone or whatever, can do that. So you're not kind of trying to jump into messing with people's mobile telephony and these kind of things. But you're actually then giving people the ability to use these devices within the Cisco systems. Oh yeah, with Cisco voice systems. That would seem a much better use of time and a much more enabling technology.
I guess if you want to be number one or number two, you have to do it yourself. Or at least you have to be seen to be doing it yourself.
Yeah, so that, I guess.
Because the big banks aren't going to buy a Nexus One phone and then put an application on it and use it on Cisco's PBX. They want an end-to-end guarantee. So I guess that's for them. Yeah. I still think nobody's going to buy it. But you make a good point, too, is that I wonder what – I wrote an article over the weekend about why the Cisco CS isn't really innovative or even exciting or even modern. It's just a rebadged Android phone in a bigger form factor. It's not OOR and all that. But interestingly, the Apple
FaceTime.
There's
missed two iPads.
Well, I think you make a good point. If you could run this as an application on any Android phone, wouldn't that work? So that extend that. What about an application on an iPhone? Take that a step further.
Exactly. Why not?
And you have a look at Apple's FaceTime, which is their video conferencing camera gimmick in their phones. That FaceTime is already SIP-enabled. The only difference between it and H323 or video conferencing is the fact that it uses a H264 video codec, because that's the hardware. You know, in the iPhone, they have a piece of chip in there, silicon accelerated for video. So all they did was say, well, we're not going to put a software codec in to do video conferencing. We're going to use that to get the best battery life out of the phone, FaceTime. So what they really need to do is Cisco needs to go and get with Apple and say, can we have a FaceTime interface to our PABX? And there you've got. We've got something much better than this thing, surely.
The thing that jumps out at me is the bandwidth utilization that they're going to drive. If I did have these densely populated in my office buildings and things, you know, how many access points am I going to need now? One per user, something like that. I mean, this thing's going to drive some bandwidth utilization with high definition video conferencing.
Coming soon, Cisco roof tiles. Each one with an access point. you're all in one roofing and wireless solution.
Yes.
You jest, Greg, but I mean, there's a wireless project I did a while ago where it wasn't far off that you were pretty much having. I mean, they wanted to do everything on wireless. They wanted to run the whole business on wireless, and the guys who went off and did the survey pretty much put an access point above every pod. So you sort of got like six guys and an access point above them, and the crossover was awful on it. I mean, it just didn't work at all. It was terrible.
People are also convinced that they need gigabit to the desktop. And if you're trying to say that you don't need gigabit to the desktop.
You're right, 10 gig.
At least.
And Fiber Channel for every desktop. Set them up, bartender.
You get to this point where it's getting so dense with wireless devices that you know you're almost sort of needing to sort of do wireless in a different way. It's not actually particularly practical to do conventional wireless if you've got everybody sitting there doing this kind of real high bandwidth applications. I don't know.
Well, what you're really looking at is that the current wireless solutions aren't really ready for the enterprise. They're not fast enough, they're not reliable enough, they're not anything. They're not bad as niche or point solutions, and they work occasionally. But I think the mistake that some people make too with wireless solutions is they try and make them gigabit. But they aren't. They can't run at gigabit. There's not physically enough spectral bandwidth to make that possible. So trying to pretend that you need gigabit to a desktop and then you're going to do it over wireless is a fallacy. People need to wake up themselves and say, well, if I do wireless, I'm going to give them a maximum of 25 megabits per second per workstation. You know, that print job might actually take 15 seconds longer. Big deal. Who cares? Maybe I'm just ranting again. All right. The other thing that Cisco did this week, not this week, I just want to point out, there's a thing at Cisco called home energy management, which makes a nice contrast against the Cisco CS. I see the Cisco CS tablet thing as a me too, gives them a marketing message and gets them a bit of press on the front line, but otherwise they're just masturbating themselves about products. And the home energy management system, however, is something very different. Cisco, for example, has made a huge attack onto the home energy market, where they are actually releasing products which are energy controllers for power smart grids. And I'll put a link in the show notes and go and have a look at a system which actually shows you home energy management systems. Now, this is a brand new marketplace that Cisco's playing in, which is all about providing a tablet-based device that actually monitors the power and everything in your home. And it's linked back to the electricity companies. So Cisco's out flogging this electrical product to the power companies to say, you need to actually put these smart grids so that we can manage people's power in their homes. And when we need to shed peak load, we can intelligently turn off TVs and fridges and air conditioners and all this sort of stuff. That, to me, is a perfectly legitimate marketplace which Cisco can move into and dominate and get growth. Going out and buying flip video cameras and home toys and producing fluffy bunny bears with batteries in the back doesn't seem like an exciting use of Cisco's time and resources. Rant over.
They have the Greg, they have the resources to do both, I think, is really the point.
I'm not convinced of that. I think what we're seeing is that management are losing their way in the core business, and that's why we've got product shortages. The support levels are slipping, the stock on spare parts is slipping, and the software development cycle is slowing. And that, to me, especially at the executive level. The executive level's off having meetings with Uncle John's meeting with President Clinton and Obama and President Medvedev of Russia, but he's not attending to the day-to-day business.
No, I tend to... I look at the product announcement like the CS and say they can't ship me a router in a timely fashion so that it's holding up projects. But yet they're introducing this thing, which by all accounts is a toy or a premium luxury item for high-end business users, however you want to categorize it. And it's something that really should be in the consumer space. How can they have all the energy, time, and so on to do that, but yet can't seem to resolve this lead time problem, which has been going on for several months now? It's frustrating and it's upsetting as someone who's been dealing with Cisco for over 10 years now, and running into these problems with a company that's this large and this mature, it shouldn't be happening.
Okay, one last thing on Cisco Live then is that Cisco this year has been heavily promoting their Cisco Virtual Live experience, which is some website thing. Previously, I've actually logged into this, and I thought it looked as ugly as a hat full of arseholes. And really, it was just a bloated piece of trash. It runs this Flash client. There's just so much going on the screen. And fair dinkum, it took me 3 hours to find my way through the interface just to be able to download a PDF of a presentation, which is all I wanted. You know, when you go along to Live, you get given a free login so that you can download all the presentations to save Cisco the 5 cents it costs to give you a CD instead, you know, when you're there. Have you guys used it, and do you have any sort of a view on what that is?
I was going to say, so this year they went back to handing out a flash drive with all the PDFs, so it wasn't necessary to log in, you know, if you were actually at the event.
No, I was going to say, I've tried to log into it a couple of times. As you're probably aware, there's a kind of a free version for tight asses like me, where you can go in and you see a few of the basic presentations that are available. And didn't even get to the point where I could get to actually what I wanted to get to, and just gave up. I just found it unusable. It's far too complicated for what they're trying to do.
It's outsourced to some company. They actually approached me for feedback, and halfway through my feedback, they hung up on me.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I don't think they really wanted to hear that. No, I didn't like it much. So we'll see what happens. Brandon, have you tried to use it at all?
I have, and I just don't really get it. I don't get the whole virtual floor. I don't get how you're going to have vendors pay for virtual booth space, and I can't see them getting any traffic through it. I don't see any benefit from a vendor perspective. I get that you have the live space where we can download the PDFs. That's great. And I sort of get the whole tie-in to, you know, Twitter and the hashtags and being able to maybe more easily communicate, but it was just – it's too difficult to navigate, and it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. No, I didn't like it.
Yeah, that was my experience of the interface.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with the difficulty part, but once you do get to the content, it's pretty good content. It's the Cisco Live presentation. So it's the PDF synchronized to the voice of the actual presenter during whichever, you know, version they recorded the voice on. So where I found that really useful was when I was preparing for the CCDE written and lab, or practical, I guess they call it. I was able to go back and, you know, hit up some presentations that I hadn't attended live. And in fact, this year when I set my Cisco Live, you know, on-site schedule, I purposely did it around presentations I thought I wouldn't be able to get through the Cisco Live virtual interface. So some of the panel discussions and some of the less popular presentations, like designing ISIS networks that never seem to make it online with audio. So if you put in the effort and really fight through that interface and get to the content, it can be pretty valuable stuff.
Yeah, I guess my whine is that the interface is rubbish. The website's...
And that...
Is
I agree 100%. Yeah.
And when I told the company that did that, they actually just bothered me. I just can't understand how they can possibly imagine that's worthwhile. And if it is, it's another symptom of Cisco marketing being way off base. All right. Are there any other things from Cisco Live that we should be covering, or have we just about done it to death? I think we've done it to death then.
Yeah.
There are a couple of things that did come up out of Cisco Live, but we'll push those off into next week because we're getting on to later in to close out the show. So the topic that we wanted to close out the show this week was that Network World pushed out an article this week about Cisco's finding that 20 young people, 20-somethings, don't like working in tightly controlled networking environments. What a shame.
Right, that article was all about they don't want to have restrictions on what social media they can hit. They don't want to have restrictions on being able to listen to streaming radio and these kind of things. They expect the work environment to give them the same kind of internet access that they might have at home, just kind of wide open and free and do what you want and so on.
I don't know about you, but you know, I'm 40-something and I've still got the same problems about kowtowing to the corporate line.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that article also talked about how this shows the risk in their borderless network campaign, right? And it's just, to me, a little baffling. The borderless campaign is about, what do they call it? Anytime access to anything. But, okay, well, then your ASAs, your corporate firewalls, fall underneath the borderless networks campaign. So you got a security device that's going to be wide open to give you anytime access to anything. Doesn't make sense.
Well, I'm still mystified to what borderless networks is all about. So here's an open invitation to anybody from Cisco who works in the marketing team for borderless networks to come on and let me have a go and tell me all about it, because I'm baffled. I've spent 4 to 8 hours reading through the material trying to make head nor tail of it, and I'm lost. I don't understand.
Well, I asked them at Cisco Live, you know, if somebody could explain it to me, and they basically said, okay, well, you have your video and voice, which is where your telepresence and all that's at. Then you have your data center, and then you have everything else. And everything else, we'll call that borderless networks.
Yeah. I did a poster on this which basically said we've got so much stuff we don't know what to do with it, so we've just called it borderless networks. If you go
Greg, you were saying something before that I thought was interesting. You said I've still got my challenges, you know, bowing to the corporate line. And that started my brain spinning here, because we got these 20-somethings who want to come into the office. They want to be accepted into the workforce and do their thing. But they want to still have, you know, freedom and so on, and don't want to be restricted by corporate policies. You know, the man keeping you down, you know, that kind of thing. So what's the balance between security, you know, the far extreme being this ridiculous borderless networks campaign that we've been talking about, and on the other end, having a tightly controlled, very secure environment where you're forced to go through a proxy server and there's a lot of URL filtering and you can't access your personal email from work and they've locked out the USB keys, so you can't pop in a drive and so on. How do you balance it?
I'm not sure there is no automatic balance. Every organization is going to be different. So, for example, where I work now is a restricted environment. Everything's controlled. Desktops you can't do anything with. No USB. Fully filtered internet. Everything's blocked, basically. And yet I've worked for the other extreme, where I've worked for .coms, where you can bring along your own computer and use your own phone and you work from home, you work from wherever you are, and it goes. The answer is different businesses have different capabilities, and some of them are forced on them because of security requirements. You know, like, for example, working on military sites, there's a good reason as to why the restrictions are in place. And yet for .com, there's almost no secrets because it's obvious what they're doing anyway, and there's only a certain amount of stuff which is restricted. So what's the balance? The answer is you've got to try and find a balance in your working life where you're achieving the things that you wanted to do. Let me also point out that Facebook is not an achievement. Facebook is a personal indulgence. So your ability to tell your friends that you're sitting at your desk at work is not exactly an achievement, and you're not actually delivering anything of value to the world. All you're doing is masturbating your ego, really. Yeah. So forget Facebook when you're at work. If you're on it, there's no excuse for using it. You can claim that. I often find personally that, you know, relationships, professional relationships through Twitter and through my blog are becoming increasingly valuable to me. But that's an entirely different thing, because the only thing I use it for is professional stuff, like, you know, networking related. And my ability to be able to ask a question on Twitter and people to come back to me and give me, you know, advice on how to do something or what their experiences are is enormously valuable to me, because I'm often not got a lot of resources where I am. And
I completely agree with that, especially on Twitter. Twitter's interesting because you pick up certain followers, and I tend to follow back, but I always screen them. I look back at who it is that's following me, and I look back at their history, what's in their timeline. If they're saying about the last time they went to this restaurant, or I am so drunk right now you wouldn't believe it, and so on, and the signal-to-noise ratio is very low, if you want to follow me, great, but I'm not interested, because I use it for that. But then I look at what a lot of other people do, you know, younger people particularly, what's up on their screens if I am walking by the cube or whatever. I work in an environment now that's more open versus my previous environment, which was what you were just describing, like very locked down. You couldn't do much of anything, social networking related, that kind of thing. But a lot of these people that I walk by now, it's just, it's their life's an open book, and things not even vaguely work or professionally related are what's up on their screen at work.
Yeah.
Being one of the guys that's having to deal with security, it drives me a little batty. I think these 20-somethings have unrealistic expectations if they think the workplace is an extension of their personal life, because it isn't.
No. I must also point out that I remember when I was 15 and I went to work at, I think, Flipping Burgers somewhere or another, and they told me that I had to stand there and I could only have my breaks when I had, you know, this and that's the rules, and there's no I felt pretty much the same as what this article sounds like, and it sounds like standard whining. So, you know, the answer is when you come to work, you work, and it's different, and if you don't like it, then go somewhere else. So
yeah, I mean, what I've kind of seen is that when you're 20-something, your work life and your social life are kind of the same thing. It's not until you kind of get older, get married, you know, have something going on outside of work that that people see that separation.
Oh, so you're saying we're all old. That's what you're saying.
We are old. That is definitely true. Whether there's a point behind that or not, I'm not sure. We are old.
That's very harsh. I resemble that comment.
Exactly.
As do I.
Oh. Brandon, you deal with young people perhaps in your training role more. Do you find them, any of them, whining about that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. It's because it's got to be on their schedule for them, right? It's got to be about what they want to do and not, you know, it doesn't matter what the business has in mind. You know, I think a lot of young people now, I mean, they look at working at a company as not really a benefit to them, as a benefit to the company. Well, you got me here, and I'm going to do what I want on my time, and if you're not going to give me the access, I'll just whine about it. So,
yeah, standard teenage stuff. In other words, it's a non-article. All right. Well, yeah. I think that's it for the show this week, and thank you for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our world-class guests for joining us this week. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. I had a great time.
And you,
Jeremy,
can find,
where can people find you?
I can be found on my blog, jeremyphilippin.com, or Twitter, jphilippin. I think I'm pretty easy to find out there, so feel free to do it.
And, of course, I'd like to thank Brandon Carroll for joining us this week.
Yeah,
Brandon,
thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Carroll. You can find me on the blog, which has unfortunately become a little less frequent these days, but at globalconfig.net or in one of the classes over at Esculta.com.
Fantastic. And, of course, let's not forget Dan Hughes. Dan blogs at blog.aloran.co.uk and on his Twitter handle at Dan Hughes 1234IE. And, of course, the stalwart of the packet pushers, Ethan Banks. Ethan, tell us about yourself again.
Well, first of all, I have to say I think I'm the only one that hasn't missed an episode yet, so I get a week off at some point here. But you can find me at packetattack.wordpress.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks.
And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. We would love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net and feel free to leave a comment on today's show. We also really appreciate it if you get time to go up onto iTunes and leave a review. That really helps us get up the list a bit higher and get exposed to more people. And I'm really thankful for the people who've done that for us over the last couple of weeks. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.